Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening this morning. Of all the uncertainty about where we're headed with the pandemic, one of the most urgent questions is about schools. Will they reopen in the fall? Can kids and teachers be safe? Can distance learning improve if schools have to be closed? Last week, the Minnesota Education Department unveiled three different scenarios for schools, and we'll talk about the challenges of each for teachers and students and parents. I think we also have to acknowledge that there are many unknowns, but we can give you an idea of what school leaders are grappling with and what medical professionals have to say about the risks to kids and teachers. So as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from parents and teachers this morning. If you're the parent of a school-age child, what do you want to hear from the state and the schools themselves about how they're preparing for the fall? Have you decided yet whether your child is returning to school in the fall? So parents, asking to hear from you on what kind of direction, what kind of guidance you want from the schools, and whether you've already made this decision about whether your child is returning to school in the fall. And teachers, I see you on Twitter. I'm really curious to know how you're grappling with this. I know you want to be back in the classroom, but how are you assessing the risks here, especially given about some of these scenarios that the Minnesota Education Department gave us? So what are you most concerned about, teachers? How are you managing this? And parents, have you made a decision? What do you want to hear from the schools? Okay, here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Christine Osorio is the superintendent of North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale School District, and she's with us today from North St. Paul. And superintendent, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Carrie. It's really great to be here.
Dr. Jenna Wheeler is with us, a pediatric critical care physician at Arnold Palmer Hospital for Children in Orlando, Florida. And she's with us from Orlando. And Dr. Wheeler, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. Thanks so much for asking me to join.
Superintendent, I notice that there is a lot of daylight between these different scenarios that the state offered up late last week. Yes, I hear you chuckling too. Are they so broad that they're really not giving you a direction for planning, or are they giving you some kind of outline about where you can go with this?
Well, I'll agree. They're quite broad. You may know that the three scenarios that have been presented to us are, number one, back to school, everybody's back in person. Number two is a hybrid model, partly in person and partly distance learning. And scenario number three is all distance learning like we were doing this previous spring. And as you know, that kind of covers the whole gamut right there.
It does.
So, yes, to some extent, it doesn't tell us too much quite yet about what to do. However, I think all of us have already, I mean, anyone I know has already been planning for those three scenarios, trying to think what they might look like. So I think it's a first step to directly hear it from the state that these are the three scenarios that exist and really trying to put together our thoughts and thinking around each one of these three. It is a pretty broad scenario. The state has said that the week of July 27th, they will tell us which scenario we will be going with. Mm. So we can kind of plan, but we know that that's going to be the date that we're going to find out for sure.
Now, of those scenarios, some of them are probably more difficult to plan for than others. So are you able to plan for the more challenging ones, even as there is so much uncertainty about what's going to happen? I mean, can you start doing that now?
Yes. And I'll tell you one thing that we've done right now. So we all know that we were kind of thrown into this world of distance learning this past spring. And so one of the first things we've done is we've done a survey of our families, of our staff, and of our older students to find out what was working for you, what wasn't working, and where to go from there. What I have told my staff is, let's get really, really, really good at distance learning. Mm. Let's figure out where we had some mistakes, some things we weren't ready for, and let's plan for that, because it's much easier for us to go back to in person, right? I mean, that's what we've been doing previously. We're used to that. Distance learning was a whole new ballgame for us. I mean, taking a 200-year-old education system and changing the delivery model was not easy. So my thought is, let's work on the hardest thing to do, which is to get better at that. And then any version that lands less than that or more in person is going to be obviously old hat for us. We're used to doing that. So I think that's kind of what our focus has been. Focus on whatever is the most difficult, and let's figure out what are the digital resources we didn't have. What are the training and the professional development our teachers needed that they didn't have time to get? What are lessons learned that families have shared with us and students? What was their lived experience in that environment? Taking all that feedback, and that's what we're focusing all of our summer professional development around.
Good. I will have more questions about the distance learning, I'm sure. But Dr. Mm-hmm. Wheeler, Jessica says, as a middle school educator, I really want to be in school with students, but I taught about 200 students last year. I'm very nervous about educator exposure in upper grades. No idea how to plan science labs without sharing supplies or how to non-verbally communicate with masks. Now, Dr. Wheeler, Florida, the governor has announced that schools will reopen in August. And the state education commissioner there said they're doing this because kids are at extremely low risk. Balance what you're hearing from your state officials with what we're hearing from teachers who are nervous about going into the classroom. What should they know?
I think being nervous going back into the classroom is completely expected. I think both from teachers and educators and staff, and then also from families sending their students. And those are things that, you know, Florida going back to school a little bit earlier than some other places in the country that they've had to work on and be addressing and putting out information to their staff and to their families. There are some real concerns. School in general, even before COVID, was a place where you're putting a lot of people together in a small space. You're putting kids together who don't understand, you know, washing their hands all the time. They share everything, including germs. And so as we look toward this, I think it's going to be a balance of trying to make sure that we can get our kids good education. Like this teacher was asking about, you know, science labs, those mm-hmm. are difficult. And there may have to be more things where it's more demonstration-based, which is unfortunate because that's, you know, engaging kids in experiments is how they learn, how you stimulate them, how you get that interest growing in them. But there may have to be some more creative ways. I think Florida's talking about this lower risk of spread, and we're all happy in the country that children seem to be a little less affected by COVID, but they still can get COVID. Our pediatric numbers are rising. Thankfully, they're not critically ill, but they are. It is there, and it's a very real concern, not only just to spread amongst themselves, but spreading them to teachers, to staff, to people who may take it home, to their family members who aren't healthy and could be at risk. And I think those are all the considerations people are really working with right now.
Yeah, Dr. Wheeler, just a note on this before we take some calls. You mentioning the risk of contagion. I saw this study out of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Just came out, I think, late last week. Kids under 19 are only half as likely to be infected with the novel coronavirus. And then if they are infected, they are much less likely to be symptomatic. So that seems like a double-edged kind of sword of research there. You wouldn't know which kids are potentially sick and spreading because they're not showing symptoms, and yet we know that they are less likely to actually contract it. How should schools take in information like that to make decisions?
Well, I think in the middle of this, one of the things that we have to remember as more and more information is coming out is that unlike some circumstances where we can look at all the data and we can plan accordingly, everything's changing around us. We're having studies coming out on a daily basis that it's not that other ones were inaccurate. It's just that we're gaining more information as we go forward. And that makes it a little more difficult to plan for. I think we have to know that children can get infected with COVID. We know that they can be asymptomatic carriers. And so with that information, you don't want to assume that everyone is just, you know, walking around with this illness, but you need to have kind of a level of understanding that all of these children are at risk. They could have the virus and they have the potential for spread. Thankfully, the thought is that children don't have as much likelihood of spread as, say, an adult would. And so there's a little less risk, mm-hmm. but there's still a risk. And so we have to be incredibly diligent about following, you know, local guidelines, CDC guidelines regarding mask wearing, regarding, you know, keeping the classrooms clean, which I know teachers were doing well before this, of, you know, taking time wiping down desks and wiping down shared spaces. And I think we have to just implement everything that we can and then move forward and continue to focus on education and be looking at the new data as it rolls out and be ready to change our plan if we need to.
Dr. Jenna Wheeler from Arnold Palmer Hospital for Children in Orlando is handling the medical side of this conversation about what to do about kids going back to school in the midst of this pandemic. And Superintendent Christine Osorio is with us of Independent School District 622. That's North St. Paul, Maplewood and Oakdale schools. And we're hearing her firsthand experience about what it's like to grapple with different scenarios and try to make plans and take all the questions that I'm sure are coming in from parents and teachers. So we thought it was important to have a conversation about this today. If you're the parent of a school-age child, I'd like to know how you're feeling about this right now. Are you starting to make some decisions, given what you're hearing from the school district, from the state, from the research on this? Have you decided whether your child is going back to school in the fall? And teachers, what are you most concerned about? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, to Mara in Hopkins. Hi, Mara. Thanks so much for calling. What do you want to know?
Well, I am a high school teacher at in District 621, so just neighboring to your superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And I have multiple sclerosis. So I'm immune compromised. I'm a little concerned about what that will look like if I have five classes of between 30 and 36 kids.
Yeah.
We've got a 5-minute passing time, so I don't know that I have enough time to wipe down 36 desks in between. And then where are the students while I'm wiping down all the desks? Are they standing outside of my room, huddling in the hall, all not social distancing?
Right.
It's tough. It's very tough. And I have a 9-year-old son at home. So if we don't go every day, what do I do with him if he doesn't go every day on the days when I do go?
Yeah, I can see why this is occupying a lot of mind space, Mara. Superintendent Osorio, how would you make allowances for teachers who might be immune compromised, but also teachers who also have children of their own? This is challenging. How are you thinking about it?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I think the version of this plan that's going to probably be most complicated, we talked about scenario one that the states put out would be in-person. Scenario two would be a hybrid. Scenario three would be all distance learning. Scenario two, and I think to what Mara's point calling in is, if your student, let's say a hybrid is your child goes to school every other day, we hear a lot of articles coming out right now in the administration is, how do you de-densify, right? This is a whole new concept. We're all thinking about de-densify our spaces. Well, a high school is a perfect example of a really difficult place to do that. Even our cafeteria, how do you ever have enough? I mean, you see how many hundreds of kids are in a cafeteria at a time, especially in our larger comprehensive high schools. It's a very legitimate concern, and there's a whole lot of things that we're talking about and we're planning for, but one thing we really, in top of our thoughts, are our immune-compromised staff and our students. We've talked about all kinds of things, from how do we order enough face masks? I've never heard of these face masks that have a clear shield in front of them.
Ah.
We talked about our speech and language therapists. Like, if you have a mask on, you can't work as easily with students. They kind of need to see your mouth. Our new English language learners, for example. So somebody came up and found these masks that have a clear piece over the mouth, stickers for floors for social distancing, plexiglass at all of our reception areas. But it comes back down to that issue of those concentrations of where you're going to have your students in your room. We've been having conversations about who and when does all of the sanitizing, right? We have, you know, most of our districts are unionized, and we have to think about, you know, I actually had a conversation with our custodial union. You know, I know this is your job to do the cleaning. So if you take away the work and give it to somebody else, is that taking away your work from a bargaining group, right? And so,
yeah.
And so then we've even had conversations too about what kind of cleaners could we have high school students be safe to be allowed to use? You know, is there something they could help be wiping down desks in between classes? All these conversations, even on school buses, we had a large conversation about wiping down all the seats between the rides. But there's some guidelines about school buses not allowed to transport any certain amounts of toxic liquids on board. So then we talked about, well, can they all be on wipes? And then that's a lot of wipes, and there's a shortage of wipes if you can't have a big bottle of spray on the bus. And there's a lot of guidelines we have to work around to figure these things out. So we have a long list. We've got a COVID response team put together. We're just about to start brainstorming all these scenarios, and one of the big things is to make sure we buy the supplies we need now so that we don't have a shortage of them when fall comes. So I wish I had a better answer for Mara, because I think her issue is very real. And I also think one of the greatest challenges is going to be daycare if we don't have students in school every day, or if they're not home all the time, or in daycare or in school all the time. The alternate day stuff is going to be really tricky.
Yeah. Angela says on Twitter, I'm very apprehensive about sending my third grader back. I've read about what some other countries are doing in schools to keep kids separated. I'm not sure our country is putting enough money into that much infrastructure. Patty says, this will be my 37th year as a seventh grade science teacher this fall, and I turn 60 this summer. Wonder how we can safely return and not work in groups or share microscopes, lab tools, computers. Will kids see this as real school or just a version of online learning at school? Dr. Wheeler, mm-hmm. I have a question for you about what the superintendent said as she thinks about these different sanitizing processes. Give us some ideas about how parents can assess whatever sanitizing plans the schools are going to announce, like, you know, it's kind of a smart approach to, well, this is what the school says they're doing, and what kinds of questions should I ask about that?
I think that looking at sanitizing, a lot of it is, it's having a conversation between parents and students and teachers. And, you know, I don't envy the schools and the superintendent for having to be thinking about all these things on top of how much effort goes into just putting an education program together. And so for the teachers and to have the parents and the students come alongside, and then, you know, parents need to say to the teachers, what do I need to be instructing my child that the expectation is going to be? That the expectation for my child is going to be that they walk into a classroom and they use hand sanitizer immediately. That's something that parents can be working on with kids even, you know, over the summertime, getting used to when you walk into your home. Let's make sure we either wash our hands if there's a sink available, or we use sanitizer. You know, let's make sure after we eat a meal at home even that we're wiping down that surface with, you know, whatever that family decides is a good product to be using. And to be getting kids kind of in the mindset of thinking about, you know, kind of healthy hands and healthy spaces around us. And then sending them to school with that mindset already in place for the teachers then to kind of pick up and say, you know, the rules for our school, the rules for this classroom, this is what's been decided based on, you know, what products have been deemed safe for the classroom, what's best available. And then they can kind of go alongside and shift that over to the classroom setting.
Oh, that makes sense.
The focus wouldn't necessarily be on cleaning. That would become kind of the commonplace expectation. And then the focus could shift again to education, because that's the whole reason that we want our kids to be back in classes, for their education.
So start this summer with your kids with some of these, you know, sanitary procedures that we're doing, and then take that into the classroom. And that'll be on top of whatever the school is doing. Is that right?
I think that would be a great start. And the same goes with masks. You know, if you're in a school district in a state and county that is requiring masks, and we know that masks are a wonderful thing to prevent spread, have your kids practice wearing a mask at home. You know, our kids have been home for so long now in the summer, and they're certainly not wearing masks within the home setting generally, unless they would have a reason to be. And getting used to that, getting used to having kids wearing the masks for a period of time, talking with them on, learning to not touch their face constantly when they have this face covering on. Those are all things, again, especially in the younger kids, that can really help the teachers, you know, have students who are already accustomed to that so that the teachers are just doing gentle reminders
right.
instead of it having to be kind of a whole learning practice.
That's good advice. To the phones to Aaron in Hopkins. Aaron, you're a teacher?
I am a teacher. I teach at a high school. I am high risk for infection, and I have a couple other points. I teach in a very red district, so while I already don't trust the students to wash their hands, mm-hmm. I have trouble trusting the parents of these students to adhere to the guidelines. And so my real question is, would a school district or superintendent rather have a long-term substitute live in the classroom or me, a trained master's teacher, virtually?
So, Aaron, just so I'm clear here, you are concerned that some political allegiances are also influencing the way teachers might or the way parents might behave
for sure.
with their kids in your district. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Superintendent Osorio, sticky. I mean, there's kind of two considerations mm-hmm. there. How parents may, you know, what parents may say to their kids about how they show up on this. And then his question mm-hmm. about, do you want the experience on remote learning or you want a substitute in class?
That is a really important question. And I'll tell you straight up, I would rather have an experienced person on distance learning than a substitute in the classroom any day. I think one of the greatest concerns, I'll just add a couple thoughts to that. I think one thing we were talking a lot about in my school district is we have to decide what our district rules are going to be regarding masks and hand washing. And those are our school rules. I mean, it's not about, I agree with what Aaron says. I think that there's, you know, I was just talking to some high school students last week and I said, you know, back when I was a kid, whatever, in the 70s and early 80s, there wasn't such a divide between Democrats and Republicans, right? You could be friends, you could be married to each other, and people were friends, and we're so polarized right now. And I was just telling some students, you know, I feel like there was a time where a health crisis would have brought us together, not polarized us even more. And it's unfortunate that that's happening. But I agree with Aaron. I share a lot of those concerns. And I think the answer is we have to develop our school rules and stick to them. If our rules are that, you know, all kids are going to be wearing masks or kids beyond certain grade levels are going to be wearing masks or staff are, then those are just our rules. And whatever the society believes is one thing, but we get to have our rules about how we run our school systems. And I think that's where we have to take a stand. I think the other thing is we have to continue back to that point about distance learning. One of our greatest concerns with distance learning are the kids who are falling through the cracks, the kids who have less access to internet. I'm in a school district that's very, very high poverty. We're a suburb district, but our demographics pretty much match Minneapolis public schools mm-hmm. identically. We have had a lot of issues with students who don't have an internet home, and we've sent a lot of those mobile hotspots home, but they get really slow when a number of kids are on one at the same time in a household. There's all kinds of issues with that. So what do we do to try to make sure students don't fall through the cracks? And if we're going to do distance learning, one of the things we're trying to focus our professional development on is how do we do a really good job of differentiation? How do we meet the needs of individual learners who might not be doing so well in that environment, and how do we get really better at that? If I could add one more conversation about the earlier question about students, you know, and some research saying that students, you know, don't get COVID and don't get it as seriously.
For sure.
This is a big conversation that's existed in my district. Many of our students live in multi-generational homes. And I think so often that point gets overlooked when you talk about whether students are at risk at school.
Yeah.
And I have many, 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 many families I've spoken with. And we have a lot of immigrant families. And families live in multi-generational homes. And so a grandmother or grandfather could be caring for a child. And so it's not always just about whether kids will stay healthy at school. They go home to not only grandparents, but even like Aaron mentioned and Mara mentioned earlier, even some parents of school-aged children who aren't elderly also have immune-compromised conditions. And so there's a real fear
of bringing COVID into the home, whether you as a child may not get super sick, but you've got people that you're potentially infecting. And so that's a whole nother layer that I think so often gets overlooked when we talk about young kids and schools and COVID.
Yeah. Deb in Moorhead says, I'm a grandmother of a soon-to-be first grader. I see so many people without masks that I really don't think it's safe. I would rather be the child care for my daughter than risk it. John says from South Dakota, I've got a daughter with five boys. She says that if school ends up doing a form of digital education again, she will just pull them and homeschool. It's too hard for that many kids. To Maria in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hi, Maria. What's your situation? What are you thinking about this?
Hi, Carrie. So I have two kiddos in elementary, and distance learning was really, really hard this spring. And I haven't heard anybody talk about a high level where we keep the upper grade levels in distance learning mode, where they're more likely to be able to handle distance learning, and bring the elementary kids back, but spread them across all district buildings to allow for smaller class sizes, allow for more social distancing, and focus on the social emotional learning, which is the mainstay and the focus of elementary education. It is that in-person connectedness. So, and I would love to hear a little bit about that.
Older kids, distance learning, younger kids in schools, but spread out. Is that essentially what you're asking?
Yeah, spread out. Okay. Utilize all district buildings to have smaller class sizes. Create smaller pods that allow for better contact tracing from a public health standpoint, and you still bring the elementary kids who need that in-person connectedness to develop those skills, and they're not being set behind.
Superintendent, is that the kind of plan that might be under consideration?
I think it's really ironic, Maria, that you brought that up, because that's exactly how we are doing summer school in District 622. I know school districts across Minnesota had a choice of whether or not they would continue distance learning or do some sort of a hybrid model, and we opted for the hybrid model. I know it's not as easy, and actually I'm facing a lot of these questions and scenarios with teachers right now about safety in the classrooms because we're doing summer school here, and we opted to do exactly that. Our students in our youngest grades are going to be coming in person. They're going to be in groups of nine students and one adult, and we're going to be using a lot more classroom spaces than we ever have in the summer before. Older students are going to be on devices, and they're going to be doing digital learning and distance learning because they're more able to do so independently. So at the elementary, we're bringing our students in. The rest we're putting on to devices and doing distance learning. However, we're also bringing in some of our special needs students who need more direct contact and those who just need additional supports. But that's exactly, Maria, You read my mind, because that's exactly what we came up with, and we just felt it was so hard to ever consider little guys on distance learning plans for very long periods of time, and we're worried about the gap that's growing right now.
Dr. Wheeler, I've been wondering if you can have a situation in a school, and again, we hear Superintendent Osorio going through a lot of different scenarios and plans, but you could have this situation in a school where it is sufficient for kids, again, with the lower risk that we've talked about, but it just isn't sufficient for teachers. And then how school districts, from a medical standpoint, ought to think about that. I mean, you've got so many different age groups here to try to account for.
I think that's a great question. And you know, even as someone in the pediatric realm, those are the things that, you know, parents are asking about when you talk about the multi-generational families at home. And obviously teachers are, they're adults. They don't fall into what we're kind of considering children to be in this lower risk category. Right. And I think that that is in some ways probably even a bigger challenge that school systems are faced with when students are coming back is protecting their teachers and protecting staff. And I think that the more that we can be doing, you know, with hand washing and masks and parents really being involved when they're able to. I know that's easier in some districts than others, you know, of parental involvement and resources and such. The more that everyone can kind of go alongside each other to be supporting this, we would certainly never want to see, you know, teachers be going home and getting ill themselves or critically ill or taking that illness home to somebody else. And I think just, you know, implementing the best strategies that we can. You know, looking at healthcare workers have kind of gone through this already. That's been the biggest fear when this all started. Yeah. You know, talking to healthcare workers of the last thing that, you know, I would ever want to do working in a hospital is bring anything home to my family. That's a terrifying thought. It's caused a lot of stress for healthcare workers. And now, you know, we, I think, in healthcare who've gone through this and experienced it need to come alongside our educators and give them tips of things that we've been doing with our families and kind of, you know, the same as other first responders and, you know, our law enforcement, our, you know, EMTs, all of these people who've kind of been dealing with those fears of both contracting this virus themselves as adults and also taking it home to their families. We need to look at that, and we need to look at what we can do now for this next fold of, you know, first responders being our educators, and how can we help protect them?
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, about how schools are taking in all of the information about the spread of the virus, where this pandemic may be headed in the fall, how they know that we are, what, 8 or 9 weeks away from starting again in the fall, and how school leaders and the state educators are trying to figure out what to do about bringing kids back into the classroom or distance learning or some kind of a mix sort of program in the fall. Christine Osorio is with us. She's a school superintendent. And we've asked Dr. Jenna Wheeler to be with us, too. She's a pediatric critical care physician in a hospital in Orlando. And the medical side of this, the things that parents and teachers also have to think about as we see where this pandemic spreads in the fall. So taking your calls and your questions as a parent, how are you thinking about this? What are you wrestling with as a teacher or a school staffer? What are the questions that come up for you? What do you want to hear guidance-wise from the school district before you decide whether you can be back in the classroom? Hey, I want to tell you something from our education reporter here, Elizabeth Shockman. She tweeted that she just found out from the Minnesota Department of Education that Minnesota schools will need to accommodate a teacher who is high risk if there's a move to teach in person this fall. But she says there's not info on that in the most recent guidance because that's supposed to be a local determination. Superintendent Osorio, yet more complications for you to try to figure
exactly.
out. I mean, what yes. what can you do with that?
Well, I tell you what, we've already done quite a bit with that early on. In a couple of scenarios, gave us a little practice with that. So, as you recall, in Minnesota, part of the governor's order back in March was that schools would provide child care services for essential workers, including healthcare and EMS and police, fire, et cetera. So we've had students in our schools through this entire time from March through the end of the school year mm-hmm. already, mm-hmm. and we've had some practice with some of these issues. And some of the conversations we've dealt with are, you know, staff who would have normally been assigned to work with those students who maybe were immune compromised. And we basically figured out alternate assignments. There was a lot of work that had to be done behind the scenes, and we really we did a lot of work in that area to figure out who and how we could use people's talents and resources. And to be honest, I did a survey of my employees and basically said, you know, this is not anything that's going to be used against you, but please let us know who here is comfortable being on the front lines with students, who feels for some reason that it's not going to work for you because you're immune compromised or you have a family member that is. And we basically, it was a voluntary survey. Nobody had to do it, but it gave us some really good data and actual names of people who said, put me on the front lines. I don't have little kids at home. I don't have immune compromised people in my family. And what we were found was there was quite a few who were willing to do that. So I think it's about communication with your team, figuring out what might be some ways to use people's skills and talents in different ways. And I think that's what we just have to continue to do.
Boy, it really sounds like you are communicating at a high level there, Superintendent. I hope all your colleagues are able to do that. Call here from Kristen in Minneapolis. Hi, Kristen. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thank you so much.
Yeah, tell me about yourself.
Yeah, I just have a comment. I am a high school teacher in a First Ring northern suburb that's very similar to Minneapolis Public Schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach anatomy and biology, and I also have three kids that are six and under,
wow.
so a first grader next year.
Yeah.
So I really am very anxious about going back to school. I mean, I got into teaching because of the relationships and interacting with students, but I don't feel like our country is in a place at all where I feel like it's publicly safe. And I also feel like everybody is very inconsistent with their practices.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to have people like us who've got our as many interactions, like, limiting as possible, right? And we basically quarantined ourselves. And then you have people that are out and about and doing their thing all together in a school.
Right.
I just don't think it's safe. And, I mean, I'm saying I have three kids that young because it is a complete crazy show around here. And I'm also coming from a piece of privilege, and I recognize that, too.
Uh-huh.
But just, like, I just don't think it's healthy. Like, I have a child who's one that has a heart defect, and I'm like, I'm going to compromise health here, you know? So.
Yeah. This is such a good point, Kristen, that I'm going to take to Dr. Wheeler. Dr. Wheeler, what she's saying about some people are being strict. I've seen the video in Florida. Some people are at the beach and standing in line at clubs. I mean, how do you account for the different ways that we're handling this guidance on social distancing and risk?
I think that's a great question. I think people fall into kind of two categories of those who maybe aren't taking the appropriate precautions or aren't listening to what the guidelines and the local rules and different things are. I think there's the group of people who unfortunately just don't care. And there's, you know, really nothing that people are going to do or say outside of, you know, talking about fines and things like that that are going to get them to kind of come on board with the recommendations.
Right.
And then I think there's a group of people who just, they genuinely don't understand why we're doing this. You know, they look at it as, hey, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm willing to take the risk, I don't think I'm going to get this. And, you know, the purpose of wearing masks isn't to protect yourself as much as it is to protect others in case you happen to be one of those asymptomatic people who can spread this. And so a lot of, you know, as we've kind of talked about in our household, you know, we're wearing a mask almost as a sign of respect for other families and other people saying, you know, I care about your health, but I would never want to put you at risk. And I think if we can really kind of have that attitude of coming together as communities, as a country of, you know, I want to protect you as much as I want to protect my family. I think those things help, but I think there are definite, you know, concerns because not everyone's following it. There's nothing that we're going to be able to do to get everyone to follow these rules. And so I think we just have to be, you know, very cautious in how we're doing it and, you know, be talking to, you know, in this case, be talking to pediatricians about, you know, children who are going to be more at risk and teachers talking to their physicians if they have health concerns and letting the medical community kind of come alongside the schools as they're planning this as well to kind of help make those recommendations for teachers who may need some different considerations and students who it may not be safe to return. But
right.
I also, the other side, you know, that we haven't talked about at this point is looking at the mental health of our children and the impact that being out of school and out of just a normal routine. We all know, and I'm sure the superintendent can speak to as well, that children thrive on routine. They thrive on consistency. And so during this time of having them home, regardless of how wonderful the, you know, programs have been of trying to really distance learn and keep up with that, we've seen an increase in mental health problems amongst our kids. We've seen increase in child abuse and things like that just because we're in such a high stress setting that, you know, that needs to be factored in too when we're talking about going back to school and letting our kids see that, you know, life goes on and that it's okay that we can have some normal in the middle of all this. It's just trying to figure out how to most safely create that.
Superintendent, on the mental health, just as Dr. Wheeler was saying that, Kathy tweeted, I'm concerned about the mental health of our students. Families have been under so much stress. What are districts planning to do to support the mental health of students and teachers? I hope they see that it's more important than rushing in to catch up on lessons. So how are you thinking about this?
Absolutely. And I'll just add to it, you know, the whole situation, the murder of George Floyd and the civil unrest, there's a whole lot that is going to need to be unpacked, especially with older students. And one of the things that, you know, had this happened, you know, the George Floyd murder, had, if that had happened when school was in session, there would be, you know, obviously some conversations being had at school and some, you know, thoughtful planning of how to debrief all of that with students. And that's one of the pieces we're also working on this summer, is how to be ready and able to do that for our students, because that's going to have to be addressed. I mean, students are coming back and there's so much emotion built up with that, and that's affecting mental health. There was just an article in the Star Tribune a couple days ago about that same issue with students. And so you take COVID and then you take all of the civil unrest, mm-hmm. you know, and the deep pain and suffering in the Black community of, you know, all the systemic racist practices we have throughout all of our systems. I think you put all that together, there's a lot that needs to be unpacked. And so I'll say this, we've been really working on ensuring that we really have strong mental health workers. I mean, we, you know, everybody makes choices. We made a choice a long time ago to have a school social worker at every single site, even if it's a smaller school, just because it's so important. We've done a lot to work with outside mental health providers to augment what we currently provide in our district. And actually, we set up a lot of virtual online sessions when we were doing distance learning, and continuing to do that so that there could be mental health care done virtually as well. But it, you know, I think that's going to be one of the greatest challenges. And I love what you said about staff. We have really spent a lot of time making sure our own teachers have a chance to kind of unpack their feelings and worries and fears too, but also making sure people have access to mental health resources they need too in the adult community.
Let me grab a call here from Leah in Grand Rapids. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Hey.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll just ask real quickly. I know we're getting a little short on time, but my question is, the school system is one of the only systems in our society that has built-in kind of wiggle room in the summer months. And my question is, why, in terms of like talking about, you know, maybe spreading the kids out into smaller classrooms or having them on a staggered school day schedule, are we not talking about just using those 3 months of summer to say, you know, we're not going to be going the sheer amount of time that we need to go, but we're going to go through the summer as well for maybe the next 5 years and make this a really long-term thing? Because I feel like we're still looking at it like, oh, we just got to figure out what happens this fall. But
yeah,
it's not just that. It's really long-term. And I've asked our school board members up here in the rural north part of the state, and they don't really have any answers except that they're following all the guidelines from the state level. But, you know, can we just ask about summer? Why don't we just take advantage of it?
What do you think, Superintendent, really looking at this over the course of a number of years and then extending the school years?
I think it's a fantastic idea. I think we've been talking about it for a long time. You know, Minnesota is very much tied to this agriculture calendar.
Right.
And
outdated.
You know, it's very, yeah, absolutely. And we talk a lot about Carnegie units, seat time, cheeks in the seats, as they say. And I think there's got to be a whole new, I hope that this COVID crisis is going to really help us think differently about school. There would definitely need to be some legislative action that would need to take place in that regard. You know, a lot of school systems are built, you know, you've got labor contracts and all kinds of things would all separately need to be negotiated and changed. But I think it's something that, if there's a collective will, we can make it happen. And I think definitely would need to come with some strong legislative support to help us do that as a statewide thing. But I think the time is so overdue for that. And maybe this crisis is an impetus for changing that.
Dr. Wheeler, do you have kids, school-aged children?
I do. I have one.
So how are you? I mean, we've heard what the governor of Florida is saying about schools opening. How are you feeling about your child going back to school?
I think there's some mixed feelings. I think, you know, the initial thing is kind of a, you know, oh, thank goodness, you know,
yeah.
Goodness she's going to be back in school. We're going to have, you know, routine. I think a lot of people who've done this distance learning that it kind of came out of nowhere have those thoughts. And then the second thought is you kind of pull back and say, okay, but wait, you know, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do this where, you know, she's back in school and we're not spending every day worrying about that and what that looks like. And, you know, we were fortunate to be in a school where, while distance learning was nothing that we ever anticipated, you know, her school did an amazing job. You know, the amount of work people kind of talked about you know, teachers just doing this from home. I would say that our teachers probably put in longer days organizing distance learning even than for their classroom. Because as the superintendent said earlier, you know, classroom we've been doing for forever. Mm-hmm. But distance learning is new. And so to see the dedication of the teachers, I think has been amazing. And I think that's what gives me hope that moving forward, however this looks, that the teachers, the staff, the you know, principals, superintendents, they're going to be dedicated to the safety of my child and to the safety of, you know, my family and other families as best that they can. And I think that's why it's so important as a medical community for us to be providing that support, to be providing, you know, guidance and insight and making sure, you know, that the legislation is there so that the teachers in their classrooms can have the support that they need. But it's going to be different. You know, I think the worry is you're going to go back for a week and then all of a sudden something's going to change.
Right.
And then we're
right.
going to be shifting again.
Right.
But I do also, you know, for my daughter, consistency is a good thing. And so I'm looking forward to being back into a routine.
Dr. Wheeler, I wish you luck with whatever happens there in Florida. Really good to have your view today. Thank you. Your experience.
Thank you so much for having me.
Superintendent Osorio, I've just got a couple minutes left, but listening to what you both have been saying about what teachers have been called on to do, I saw this U.S. Census Bureau research. Teachers spend an average of 4 hours a week online and in contact with kids in distance learning. Parents are spending an average of 13 hours a week with their kids' schoolwork. I assume that cannot sustain if we're going into a fall of distance learning.
Absolutely. We're very aware of how challenging that is. And it's very clear because we also have a lot of teachers who have students themselves, kids themselves at home. And that's been something that's been brought up many times over. And I think that's really a key ingredient to, I think if you think about what Maria and her call in about this, considering a model where you bring in younger students who can't work as independently and the older students who can work more independently, maybe that's a solution out there. I'm not sure. But we definitely know that whatever, however we move forward, we cannot keep putting the burden of that kind of time onto our families for not only because it's difficult, but we also know it's very disproportionate who has parents at home to be able to do the work with them. Many families. Their parents are working,
right,
and it's
right.
not easy. So there's a real discrepancy there. That's where we're worried about this achievement gap growing as well. And I'd like to echo what Dr. Wheeler said too. I think that if you, as parents, our teachers are so incredibly concerned about the safety and well-being in their classrooms of not only the students but their own health. And so I know that there will be incredible thought. I can't imagine anywhere there wouldn't be incredible thought put into each and every minute of the day about how to keep students safe. It's not figured out perfectly yet, but I have a feeling that that our own teachers will help us make sure we do a really good job with this because they themselves are on the front lines and they care about their children and their students too. So I do have hope that whatever solution we come up with, we'll put a lot of thought and energy into doing it really well.
Boy, Superintendent, so valuable to have you on the show today. Really, really grateful for that. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Especially when I know how busy you are. Superintendent Christine Osorio is Superintendent of Independent School District 622. It's North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale Schools.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.